Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I'm Jimmy Floyd, and for Brian Lehrer, yesterday was the deadliest day of the year so far in Iraq. 42 apparently coordinated attacks, including car bombs, gunmen, and suicide bombers killed at least 89 and wounded hundreds more. And while no group has claimed responsibility, Sunni insurgents led by al-Qaeda in Mesopotamia are thought to be behind the violence. Time magazine's deputy international editor Bobby Ghosh is here to explain why the spike in violence, what it has to do with U.S. troop withdrawal in December, and the history of violence there during the month of Ramadan. Bobby Ghosh, welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks, Jamie.
Were the attacks yesterday a clear sign to you that the insurgents are ramping up and posing an increased threat? And is there any chance this escalates to the kind of violence we saw during the height of the sectarian war back in 06 and 07?
Well, that is certainly their intention. The people behind these attacks and al-Qaeda and their associate groups are as good a guess as any, are clearly aiming to trigger off another round of tit-for-tat sectarian violence of the kind I saw when I lived there in 06 and 07. Whether the Shiites are going to rise to the bait is left to be seen. They've done quite well. There have been other attacks over the past year or so that were designed, again, to do exactly that. But the Shiite groups have been quite restrained in their response, probably because they realize that they have political power and don't want to jeopardize that. As long as the Shiite groups keep their guns sheathed, I think there's a chance that they will not be that kind of sectarian violence, but it's all up in the air a little bit.
The number of American troops killed this year has jumped from last year. U.S. troops still set to leave Iraq in December, according to the Obama administration, though some forces could stay if the Iraqi government requests them. What do you make of the theory that this violence is strategic to get the Iraqi government to ask for U.S. troops to stay?
I think that's probably ascribing far too much to these attacks. I don't think the people behind the attacks care that much whether the Americans stay or leave. They're much more interested in a sectarian fight in Iraq. Al-Qaeda doesn't. You know, there's always been a school of thought that said that al-Qaeda wanted the Americans to remain on their turf, if you like, so that they could continue fighting American troops. But these attacks, as you've seen, are not directly not targeted at Americans at all. They're targeted at Iraqis. Iraqis going about their daily business. These are designed for a local response, not really an American one.
But there was the piece in the New York Times today quoting Professor Hamid Fadil. He's a political scientist at Baghdad University, and he argues that al-Qaeda of Mesopotamia and the Sunni insurgents are staging these attacks so that the Iraqi government will ask U.S. forces to stay, and the thought that if the U.S. leaves, al-Qaeda will have lost a rationale for existing, and that al-Qaeda wants to have a battleground in Iraq on which to fight the Americans. I take it you disagree with that theory.
I do disagree with it. I think particularly al-Qaeda in Mesopotamia has shown that it is much more interested in killing Iraqis and setting off a local fight than directly confronting the Americans. The American posture at the moment is primarily defensive. There are relatively few patrols. American forces, such as their strength is now, remain in inside their bases. They're out of reach of al-Qaeda, and that's not going to change. And as I said, if these attacks were designed to keep the Americans then in place, then they would have been directed at American military bases rather than at ordinary Iraqis.
And you mentioned a moment ago Shiite political power. Explain further why the Shiites would refrain from violence, sheathe their guns, as you say. Why would they stay above the fray?
Well, they have political power. They have a prime minister. They have large numbers of the members of the cabinet. They have political power in provincial governments where they have the majority. This is what the Shiites have fought for generations, arguably for centuries, for 1400 years, ever since Shia Islam split away from the Sunni mainstream. This is what they have wanted. They have wanted political power, and they know, at least the political leadership of the Shiites understand that if they go down into the gutter and fight another sectarian battle with the Sunnis, then they're jeopardizing that political power. It creates an instability. It creates conflict across the region. It brings in neighboring Sunni and Shiite countries into the fray, and it sets. It is basically bad news for the Shiites. They don't want to have to deal with all of that. They want to get on with government. They want to get on with sort of righting, from their point of view, the wrongs of 1400 years.
Let's talk a little bit more about the December troop withdrawal in light of the current violence. 2 weeks ago, the Iraqi government agreed to formally negotiate with the United States about possibly leaving some troops in Iraq after the end of this year. How do you think the spike in violence and the notion that leaving troops will play into al-Qaeda's hands would influence the negotiations?
It certainly gives al-Qaeda a little bit of a propaganda tool, but I don't think it's a huge. I don't think it's a very big one. Much depends on what those remaining troops are going to do. My suspicion is, and all the reporting we've seen out of Iraq so far, has suggested that these will primarily be in the area of intelligence and training, and that is most Iraqis, I think, Shiite and Sunni, who are caught up in all of this violence, will agree that that the Iraqi security forces need help in both those areas, security and training. And so it's unlikely to be as controversial as, of course, the other point, is how many.
Yes.
If we were talking about 50,000 troops, that's one thing. If we're talking about 10,000, then that's going to be much less controversial. That's not going to be much used to al-Qaeda as a propaganda tool.
In addition to how many is the question, how long? What would be the benchmark on the calendar for when we would bring those additional troops home? And what criteria would the Iraqi security forces have to meet, 50,000 or fewer?
Well, that's a very good point. Of course, this is now no longer, from the Iraqi point of view, this is no longer a matter of timetables. Timetables only mattered, at this point, they matter more to the American audience than they do to the Iraqis. If the Iraqis are calling the shots, if this is a negotiated deal by which the Iraqi government gets to decide how many American troops and what they get to do, then the timetable becomes less important. If the Iraqis are in the driving seat, then they will feel that they're in control.
Well, you mentioned that the timetable matters for the American people. So will it be bad politically for President Obama if he negotiates with Maliki for 50,000 American troops to stay, or however many? Will it?
Well, he'll also have to explain who gets to pay for these. If the Iraqis,
yes, he will.
If the Iraqis need American troops to stay back and help, then presumably they have to foot a large part of the bill. I can't imagine President Obama being able to sell the idea to an American public that not only will large numbers of American soldiers remain in Iraq, but the American taxpayer will pay for this. If the Iraqis are essentially contracting the U.S. military to stay back and help, then they have to pay.
And how will the Iraqi people respond to it?
As I said, much will depend on the numbers and the nature of the deal. If the numbers are small enough, 10,000 or fewer, if it's mainly for intelligence and training, and if the Iraqi security forces, the Iraqi government is clearly in control of the partnership, then I think ordinary Iraqis will not be too perturbed about this. But if there's even a hint that the Americans are in charge and that they are the ones calling all the shots, then that'll go down quite badly.
Let's take a turn to the historical context, because this is the month of Ramadan. What is the history of violence during the month of Ramadan in Iraq? Hasn't Ramadan ushered in a period of calm in the country in years past?
It's not as clear cut as that. It's a little up and down. From the point of view of al-Qaeda and the more fanatical followers, the suicide bombers and those who think that they're doing this in the name of religion, religion. Ramadan is actually a very holy month, and I've heard it argued that that is a particularly auspicious time in which to become a martyr, in which to die for a cause. On the other hand, I've also heard other people saying that Ramadan is a time for prayer and for introspection, not for any kind of violence. There are examples in Islamic history when armies have sort of ceased hostilities to observe a period of 40 days of fasting and then resumed hostilities afterwards. So depending on what your own particular political persuasion is and how you choose to interpret the faith, you can cut it both ways.
And of course, it's too much for one radio segment, because we are not just talking about Iraq. We're talking about an entire region, and we're talking about thousands of years of history.
Indeed. My own experience in Iraq over a 5-year period was that there was no clear pattern. Sometimes during Ramadan you saw long periods of relative calm, and then there were other times when there was an enormous amount of violence. Keep in mind that during Ramadan there are large groups of people who get together every evening. When you break your fast, there are big fast breaking parties known as iftar dinners. People go out in the evening to shop, to spend time with their family. So those make them sort of plumb targets for suicide bombers. People also, by definition, are going to have their guard down a little bit, because they're thinking about faith and religion and their relationship with God. They're a little less likely to be paying attention. So that it makes Ramadan a sort of, to use a military term, a sort of target-rich opportunity. So it depends on how, if you are a jihad, how you choose to cut this.
And there also have been, these last 8 years, very significant political moments at which perhaps you've been able to mark a change. The U.S. Presence in Iraq, the ouster of Saddam Hussein. Have the traditions changed, perhaps, in light of those political moments?
Again, it's hard to sort of make it to put it in black and white quite like that. In my experience, jihadi groups don't really care quite that much for timing. We've always been much more interested in timing than they are. If I've seen it once, I've seen it 1,000 times. When on a particular landmark date or at a particular landmark event, the security apparatus will go into high gear because there's an expectation that there'll be violence. But nothing of the kind happens. And then you see violence at a time when no one's expecting it, which I guess is the point.
Just as we do here. But what about in the country in general, among the people, in the culture and country?
Again, during Ramadan, people certainly will discuss politics a great deal. Every time there's a group of people get together, that's likely to happen. And so you have a lot of heated discussion, both in private as well as in public. But people are always conscious that this is a religious period, and the main point of Ramadan is religion, and your relationship to God and politics and violence are sort of secondary at best.
And then finally, let me ask you about Syria, because, of course, Syrian President Assad has ramped up his crackdown. How has the instability in Syria affected what's going on in Iraq?
It's had a great impact. I think we've already seen reports that the Syrian government, because it has brought its troops into its own cities to try and quell a rebellion there, is paying much less attention to the border between Syria and Iraq. And that has been the main conduit through which Al-Qaeda and other insurgent groups are able to move men and money and material. So I think there is a direct cause and effect between instability in Iraq in Syria, and a sort of increase in violence in Iraq.
I'm Jamie Floyd, in for Brian Lehrer. My guest has been Time Magazine's Deputy International Editor, Bobby Ghosh. Bobby, thanks for joining us.
Anytime, Jamie.
And coming up next, we will talk about Latin America redeemers and news in the area. And my guest will be Enrica Krause.